On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Real-Time Measurement of Radionuclides in Soil. Today's training was developed by the ITRC RADS team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's training. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors from the ITRC RADS team. As we go through the presentation, each of you are in control of what slide you're on. The slide number is in the upper left-hand corner, and the instructors are going to say that throughout today's presentation. If you're using the Cluent system, the series of orange buttons along the top allow you to navigate. The double left button brings you back to slide one. The single left button takes you back one slide. Most often, you'll be using that third button, the single right arrow, to move forward one slide at a time through the presentation. The double right fast forwards you to the last slide of the presentation. The house takes you back to that presentation overview page where we started today. The question mark button is there primarily for our simulcast audience. If you're in the simulcast audience and you'd like to ask a question, select that question mark button. That will allow a screen to come up. You can type in your question, and then I'll receive that as a moderator, and we'll get to as many questions as we can at the question and answer breaks. Anyone is welcome to use that button at any time during today's presentation to send in a question or a comment. For our phone line audience, you are welcome to ask your own questions out loud, but we do ask that you wait until the designated question answer breaks. We're going to have one in the middle and another at the end of today's presentation. As listed on the slide, today's training course is based on the document Real-Time Measurement of Radionuclides in Soil, Technology and Case Studies. Today's training is an introduction to this document, and we do encourage you to download the document itself. And we'll take you to a link at the end of the training that will allow you to download that document. In addition, the presentation itself is available to download. We'll go over the material on the slides during today's training class. In the downloaded version, additional information is available in the speaker's notes section. Today's training is brought to you in cooperation with the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. They host the Cluent website that we use today. Characterization of radionuclides is an extensive and time-consuming process. Using real-time technologies to complete initial screening and characterization results in more timely and cost-effective characterizations. Real-time technologies can also direct excavation, resulting in more timely and cost-effective cleanups. The result is earlier protection of human health and the environment. Today's training is going to provide some information on the basics of real-time measurement systems, talk about how the technologies and data are used. We're going to go over some acceptance issues as well as go over some case studies. If you move to slide two, using that orange right arrow button, I'm going to talk very briefly about ITRC. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States, and it's a network that's led by state regulator, including regulators from all 50 states and D.C. ITRC's federal partners include Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. ITRC also includes participants from industry, and they participate through the Industry Affiliates Program. We also include academia and community stakeholders. ITRC addresses a wide variety of topics that may focus on specific technologies or contaminants or different types of sites. And we produce documents and training like today's internet-based training. I've listed the website at the top of this slide because you can go to the ITRC website to learn more about the different items that are available. On slide three, this is our disclaimer and copyright that we include in all ITRC training presentations. We ask you please read over the slide. In short, it says we've tried to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide four, I talked about the different topics that ITRC addresses, and here's a list of the topics that were addressed in internet-based training during 2008. We're working now on our schedule for 2009, and that will be available at the ITRC website later this year. On slide five, some logistical reminders along the left if you've joined after I got started. In today's presentation, we're going to start by talking about why people would choose real-time measurements. We'll talk about the unique framework. About halfway through, we're going to have a break for questions, and we do ask that you hold all of your questions until that question-answer break. In the second half, we're going to go over some case studies, and then finish up with some observations and conclusions. At the end, we'll go to the links to additional resources page and also show you the feedback form. We do ask that everyone on the call today fill out that feedback form. We use your feedback to help improve ITRC training classes and appreciate it if you take a few minutes to fill out the feedback form. At the end, we'll have more time for questions. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors. All of our instructors are members of the ITRC Radionuclides team. Tom Snyder is the Fernald Project Manager for the Ohio EPA. He manages a team charged with implementing Ohio's Oversight and Environmental Monitoring Program at the U.S. Department of Energy Fernald site. Robert Storms is the supervisor for the Environmental Restoration Support Section of Radiological Monitoring at DOE Oversight Division for the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation located in Oak Ridge. Robert is the co-team leader of ITRC RAD's team. Ann Charles is a research scientist with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. She oversees publicly funded investigations and remediations that include radionuclide contaminated sites. Carl Spring is a project manager at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, overseeing environmental restoration at DOE's Rocky Flats site. And Carl is the other co-team leader of the ITRC radionuclides team. If you turn to slide 7, I'll turn today's presentation over to Tom Snyder of the Ohio EPA. Tom?
Thanks, Juliana. And on behalf of the radionuclides team, welcome to everybody, and thanks for participating in the training. The radionuclides team started in the late 90s and actually wrapped up its project work last year and is just continuing on at this point with the internet trainings. They did reconstitute another team called the Attenuation Processes for Metals and Radionuclides, and Carl can answer any questions about that team later during the question and answer maybe. But the team initially started out as primarily focused on DOE sites, but over time started looking at technologies and processes that could be used at basically any radionuclide contaminated site, including NRC and DOD sites. So with the intent and goal on sharing our experiences and processes that help clean up these sites quicker and better. So let's move on to slide number 8, and we'll talk a bit about the products the team developed. The team developed 5 separate documents, all of which can be found on the ITRC website. And in addition to those 5 documents, there were 5 internet-based trainings developed. And those can all also be found on the ITRC website in archive form if you can't participate in the trainings themselves. Like Juliana said, I'll throw in another plug for the D&D training that's going to be held on November 18th. It's latest installment in our training program and covers the D&D of buildings and structures. And has a lot of broad information that's useful to folks looking at clean up radionuclide sites. And again, like I said, all those documents are available on the website, all 5 documents and the trainings. Let's move on to slide number 9 and talk about why we're here today. We're here today to talk about tools that hopefully can help us improve our characterization, remediation, and closure of these radionuclide contaminated sites. We hope that at the end of the day you're going to have an understanding of the tools that are available and how they might benefit your sites and some of the considerations that need to be kept in mind as you use them. I manage the state's oversight program for Fernald, where they had 1,000 plus acres to characterize, remediate, certify, clean, and we made a broad use of real-time technologies for characterizing, excavating, and certifying the site was meeting attain the cleanup levels. So hopefully you'll be able to understand how these can be useful to your sites. They do have application across a wide variety of sites with radionuclides, including DOE sites, NRC sites, NORM sites. Basically any place that has gamma-emitting radionuclides, they can be helpful. Let's move on to slide number 9, or number 10, I'm sorry. And what you're going to learn today is hopefully get a better understanding of the basics of real-time systems, the technologies themselves. Probably very important. One of the most important aspects is the QAQC requirements, to make sure those technologies are providing you the answers that are appropriate. Case studies based on the team's experience at sites, and then a brief overview of the stakeholder and regulatory issues that we faced along the way. We will be basically referring to the document, the real-time document, and following its general format through this training. Moving on to slide number 11, brief overview of the presentation. Robert Storms from Tennessee is going to be talking about the specifics on the technologies, and Charles will discuss the important aspects of QAQC. Carl is going to discuss our collective experiences laid out in the document and with a few of the case studies highlighted in this training. And I will close with some observations and regulatory and stakeholder issues. Let's move on to slide number 12, and who will benefit from this training, and hopefully that's all of you on the line today and any of your co-workers that you might suggest download the archive version after you've participated in the training today. But it is widely applicable to sites if there are gamma-emitting radionuclides that were or are in use, and even for some non-gamma-emitting radionuclides, their daughters or progeny can be used to estimate concentrations of the non-gamma-emitting ones. They can also have applicability in Department of Homeland Security type sites or response sites for incidents or accidents, and have significant potential for those kind of responses as well. It's obviously not limited to the United States. Radionuclides are issues throughout the globe, and these technologies aren't limited to any geographic boundaries, time zones, or political subdivisions. So if you note the picture at the top of the page, Smirnoff was estimated to have saved $15 million in characterization costs alone as part of a technology deployment study. I think that cost was way small compared to how much money was actually saved during the excavation approach, where large dollars sit with idle equipment waiting on sample results to be returned. And I think that has a significant potential to be a benefit to both timeliness, costs, and safety in the end, and we'll talk a bit about that more as we go through the training. And now I'm going to turn you over to Robert Storms on slide 13. Robert?
Thanks, Tom. Real-time measurements has been one of our more popular trainings, and I'm glad everybody was able to join us today. In this first section, we will discuss the instruments and technology behind real-time measurements of radionuclides in soil and why we think this approach will be successful. Slide 14, please. Our learning objectives in the first module will cover the following points. Point one, why we think real-time measurements is the way to go, and we'll show you the value added to the remediation world. Point two, we will introduce to you the sodium iodide and high-purity germanium detectors. We will present you several platforms for these detectors. We will emphasize location, control, and mapping technologies. We will discuss real-time applications at the surface and below. And finally, we will point out the limitations associated with these technologies. Slide 15. These technologies are important for several reasons. One is money. Although EPA wanted discrete sampling, costs rose too high to make this a feasible option. Second, this technique is quicker. Results can be seen in the field and decisions made immediately, thus allowing more coverage to potential hotspots that we find out in the field. Slide 16, please. Real-time measurements are an attractive proposition for the following reasons. Cost, complete coverage, and reduction of uncertainty. Cost savings is a factor in two ways. One, lab costs are cut for verification samples, and two, by screening real-time, you limit the areas to those of concern. Complete coverage is obtainable because the instruments can scan the impacted area, and then based on the instrument's response, the workers can focus their attention on those areas of high elevation for sampling and verification. The disadvantages of real-time monitoring is its limit to gamma readings. Although many radionuclides have associated gamma with beta, a few, including strontium-90 and tritium, may go unnoticed. Alpha would be undetected. The knowledge of the and historical background of the site is important. Slide 17, please. A real-time measurement system consists of three components. A field detector to determine if radiological contamination is present, and these are usually mounted on the front or the back of the vehicle. A global positioning system, or GPS, to identify location, and a geographic information system, or GIS, to incorporate mapping and data integration. slide 18. There are two types of detectors generally used for the detection of gamma radiation in the field. These are the sodium iodide scintillators and the high-purity germanium semiconductor-type detectors. While the first records data through light rays, the second records energy pulses. These detectors will be further discussed in the following slides. Detection devices of note not mentioned in this presentation are the gas-filled ionization or Geiger-Müller counters. Slide 19, please. We'll start out with a sodium iodide. This is a solid-state radiation detector, meaning it uses a solid medium as opposed to a gas for scintillation detection. The gamma ray and sodium iodide crystal interact. As energy is deposited in the form of photoelectrons, the sodium iodide crystal converts it into a light flash. The intensity of the light flash is directly proportional to the energy deposited by the gamma ray in the crystal. The light is detected by a photomultiplier tube, and thus the intensity is counted. The sodium iodide crystal is actually doped with thallium in order to increase the light output of the crystal. The crystal is usually housed in an aluminum casing due to the crystal's affinity to moisture. The major advantage of the scintillation counter over gas-filled detectors is a much higher counting efficiency for gamma rays. The primary purpose of the sodium iodide in the field is for scanning. The instrument is very sensitive to gamma radiation, and the field technician will know a change in the field conditions quickly. Slide 20. The second instrument is the high-purity germanium detectors. This instrument operates by using semiconductor crystals. The incoming gamma ray interacts and causes ionization, which produces electron hole pairs rather than plus and minus ion pairs. The bias voltage across the detectors collects the charge. These charge pulses, once collected, pass through a resistor and produce a voltage pulse. The pulse height is proportional to the energy deposited. The output signal is then fed through a multi-channel analyzer to produce a gamma ray energy spectrum. A much better energy resolution can be seen with this instrument as opposed to the sodium iodide. Disadvantages with this instrument are cost and the necessity of liquid nitrogen at liquid nitrogen temperatures to function properly. This instrument is complementary to the sodium iodide. Peaks are more well-defined with a greater ease in identifying radioisotopes. Slide 21. We're now going to discuss mapping and location and technologies that are available to these. Available technologies include ground positioning, satellite systems, GPS, civil survey grade systems, tracking laser-based systems, and laser broadcasting systems. The GPS system, when differentially corrected, can give you accuracy to within 2 meters. The civil survey grade laser systems can give you accuracy to centimeters in all directions. But there is that cost factor involved. Isn't technology wonderful? Really, the matter of accuracy is dependent on your needs. Benefits include enhanced QAQC data sets, and this allows for completeness of coverage, enhanced documentation, and a record of your mapping is available when you're done, and an enhanced data analysis. And this is a collection of points can be better scrutinized for further sampling. Through this, full coverage is achieved at a cheaper price. Slide 22. Real-time measurement combines your detector, such as a gamma spec, with a computer and GPS system to map surface and, to an extent, subsurface contamination, giving the interested party a picture to analyze their potential problem. A number of systems are available in a range of sizes, as we will see. ITRC does not promote any of these systems, but merely wishes to give the class today an example of the many and different technologies that are available to you. Slide 23. Here's a picture of an old mounted system. The detector is handheld out to the side, and the GPS unit is carried in the pocket. The computer system, well, it's located above the shoulders, as you can see. Let's see what modern technology has brought us. Next, please. The radiation tracking system, or RTRAC, uses a farm tractor as its mobile platform. Two operators are necessary, or shall we say desired, one to control the detector system and the other to control the steering of the vehicle. The detector is attached to the rear, and a spectra is collected every 4 seconds at 1 mile per hour, which can cover approximately about an acre an hour. Slide 25. The Gator system uses the same sodium iodide detector and hardware as the RTRAC platform. The difference is the detector is mounted on the front. This all-terrain vehicle, which replaces the tractor, is used in areas with more difficult landscaping. And, oh yeah, on this model, there's no air conditioning. 526. The radiation scanning system, or RSS, finds you pushing a converted jogging stroller, only the baby is a large sodium iodide mounted in the center of the platform. This system uses the same hardware as the previous two models, but is best used in areas where trees and other objects may impede the larger vehicles. Slide 27. The excavation mounting system, or EMS, is the most recent integrated technology suite platform developed. A standard excavator is used to deploy both sodium iodide and high-purity germanium detector systems. A computer in the support van collects, maps, and analyzes data received from the detection equipment. This system was developed for use in trenches and deep excavation. 528. Other systems, of which we can't go into great detail here, but whose technology has been very beneficial for the purpose, are the SCAPS, Site Characterization and Analysis Penetrometer System, the ISOX, In-Situ Object Counting System, the GPRS, Global Positioning Radiometric Scanner, USRAD, Ultrasonic Ranging and Data System, LARAD, Laser Assisted Ranging Data System, and the GPERS, Global Positioning Environmental Radiological Survey System. There will be a test on these after the course. I'm kidding. Okay, the SCAP system uses a cone penetrometer forced to depths of approximately 50 meters in order to gather information from gamma-emitting radionuclides in soil, water, and mixed tank waste in situ. The ISOX is a portable in-situ germanium-based spectroscopy system that provides the user with information from a distance, thus minimizing exposure. GPRS, this technology uses either large scintillation detectors or a field-based gamma spec harnessed on anything from a cart to a Hummer for deployment. An onboard GPS unit attached to a computer coordinates the data with corresponding latitudes and longitudes. The USRAD technology consists of two functional units, a field survey technician equipped with probes and transmitter, and a mobile field station that receives radio and ultrasonic transmissions and records this information on a personal computer. Approximately 3,600 positions and radiometric instrument readings are recorded each hour simultaneously, producing a very accurate record. LORADS and GPERS, each of these systems uses off-the-shelf detectors, rad count meters, and computerized graphic software tools. These systems provide a real-time visual display. The laser positioning system can be used indoors. Further in-depth description of these systems can all be found in Chapter 2.3 of the Real-Time Measurement document. And I would encourage you all to take a look at these. Next slide, please, 29. Okay. The real-time approach is most effective where a dynamic work strategy is in place. And for this, real-time sampling can add benefit. There is a need for reducing decision uncertainty. Increased screening will increase the confidence level with this aspect. 3, verification and validation are an integral part of the plan. And with this, traditional sampling can be used to verify real-time monitoring platforms. And then finally, uninterrupted operations are needed. Work can continue without stoppage for lab-based sampling. 5:30. Some commonly encountered issues include the following. Large areas, radionuclides and chemical contaminants, coexisting varied contaminants, unknown or an unthorough previous characterization, and elevated area cleanup criteria. Real-time monitoring techniques can relatively quickly monitor areas for high elevations, and coexisting dump areas screening for radionuclides can also point out areas of chemical contaminants. For potential buried waste, a wide range of geophysical tools as well as intrusive sensors may be utilized. Real-time monitoring can adequately screen areas for surprise anomalies and areas of inadequate characterization, and decisions can be made quickly to respond to the changed conditions. With real-time screening, the likelihood of hot spots being missed is less likely compared to the scientific grid approach. 5:31. For real-time monitoring to be successful, the following components must be strong in a regulatory context. Data collection must be sufficient to oversee real-time monitoring results. Decisions are based on findings and lead to quick turnarounds. Uncertainty is reduced to cheaper results and more coverage. A good QAQC program is in place, and since QAQC is not one of my favorite topics, I'll turn you over to Ann Charles, who will give you a much better presentation than I ever could. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Robert. By the way, back on slide 23, I want to plug that that is a photo of Robert. So since he didn't want to point that out, I thought I'd point that out for him. We have other photos, but we can't show you them. Well, anyway, thank you. Welcome, everybody. Now that we have a basic understanding of these real-time measurement systems, what they are, how they work, I have the pleasure of talking with you about unique framework, and that's actually code for quality assurance, quality control. So what we're going to talk about is acceptance issues, QAQC, associated with using these technologies. And you can go ahead and turn to slide 33. So this slide gives you a general overview of the learning objectives for Module 2. Now, what do we mean by unique framework? Well, the requirements and methods may differ from traditional sampling and analysis. There is less acceptance at this point. The proper roles are not universally understood. The data collection approaches also are not universally understood, and QAQC procedures likewise are not universally understood. Now, by uncertainty, recognize that we don't have as much experience with these technologies, so we have uncertainty in that sense. And there are also the more technical types of uncertainty. I'll go into more detail about these within this module. Data collection approaches such as TRIAD and MARSUM, what are they? How does it apply? We're going to go over that, too, in the upcoming slides. And, again, putting on my regulator hat, using real-time measurement technologies doesn't remove the need for expertise. These technologies haven't had the same level of program development of procedures and protocols as traditional programs, but we need just as rigorous a QAQC program. So let's go ahead and turn to slide 34, please. Let's talk about requirements for acceptance and proper use. Producing good quality data is just as critical when using real-time technologies as when using the traditional sampling and send it to the lab approach. So I'd like you to think about the decision support role. Recognize that real-time fits into the overall decision support process, and it can be used for characterization, remediation, and closure, along with traditional sampling and analysis. So to reduce uncertainty and measurement error, you need to understand and properly operate the technology. Uncertainty in environmental decision-making, well, that refers to issues such as reducing the spatial uncertainty by having more complete sampling coverage with real time. Slide 35, please. Data collection approaches have advanced, and these newer approaches really complement using the real-time measurement systems that Robert was teaching you about. TRIAD is an EPA approach to decision-making for hazardous waste sites. The purpose of TRIAD is to accelerate site characterization and remediation. And the TRIAD itself refers to three primary components. We have them shown on this slide for you. Systematic planning, dynamic work strategies, and real-time measurement systems. I'd like to plug that the ITRC has published guidance and offers training on the TRIAD approach. MARSUM, for those who have a little bit less familiarity with the RAD world, that's the Multi-Agency Radiation Survey and Site Investigation Manual. And what it does is provide detailed guidance for planning, implementing, and evaluating environmental RAD surveys conducted to demonstrate compliance with a dose or risk-based regulation. MARSUM is a guidance. It's not a requirement, but it is a multi-agency consensus manual. Each of the developing federal agencies have endorsed its use. I know in my state we've endorsed its use, and since most state regulatory programs have also adopted MARSUM, there are really good reasons for using it. Our companion document, Chapter 3, goes into a lot of details on MARSUM. Within the Module 3 case studies, Carl will be teaching you about dynamic work strategies. You'll see examples of how these strategies supported site characterization, as well as how MARSUM was used to demonstrate final closure compliance. Let's turn to slide 36, please. So the real-time measurement systems are most effective when used in a dynamic strategy, like we just talked about, as in TRIAD or MARSUM, and also when reducing decision uncertainty. So think about, again, is your site characterized, remediated, ready for closure? Real-time technologies can help make these decisions faster and cheaper than traditional sampling and lab analysis alone. Just like Tom was explaining to you, think about the money savings at Fernald and the time savings as well. By simultaneous progress, during remedial activities such as excavation, the real-time data can direct your field work in a manner that allows continuous progress and verification. This will translate into saving you time and money. Realize that you'll be combining the real-time data collection with verification, sampling, and analysis data collection. You're going to have a certain percentage that will be sent to a fixed laboratory. It's an integral part of the overall data collection program. So your goal is to reach a decision on whether or not a specific area, such as a final status survey unit, meets cleanup criteria. Now, practically, again, on your projects, you'll be combining the real-time technology with some amount of traditional discrete sampling and laboratory analysis to provide a basis for those decisions. How much of that traditional type sampling is needed is going to depend on the specific objectives of your project, the capabilities of the real-time measurement systems, and your own state may have their own requirements of, you know, what percentage needs to go to a laboratory. Again, New Jersey, we have some specific guidance, so you need to check that out also as a regulator. Go ahead to slide 37, please. Now, to properly apply the real-time measurements approach, you need to understand the different types of uncertainty and manage them. Here is a brief overview on these types of uncertainty. Inferential uncertainty, how do your readings and measurements relate to your cleanup goal? Does your gross gamma data indicate that your contaminants of concern are above or below the standard? You're often measuring a proxy, a surrogate, or getting a rough approximation. The Rocky Flats, Colorado case study that Carl will talk with you about in Module 3 will give you a good example of how a surrogate is used. So we need statistics to help determine the relationship between what is measured and the concentration-based standard.
We use statistics for determining the strength of that relationship, and I will, you'll thank me. I'm going to not go through that. Instead, I'll refer you to Chapter 5 of our document for those details. Analytical measurement uncertainty refers to the concepts of accuracy, bias, and precision. Real quickly, for those who don't delve as often with the world of QAQC, accuracy is the agreement between the individual sample measurement and the true value. Bias measures the difference between repeated measurements and the true value. And precision is that scatter observed in results from repeated measurements. The more scatter, the less precision. You don't have to take notes frantically. Just go ahead and go to Chapter 5 of our document. All those definitions are there with a lot more detail as well. Regarding spatial uncertainty, you have variability across locations. So with a traditional sampling program, you're measuring probably about a half liter of soil at each sample location, and you have a set number of sample locations. So your overall coverage may be smaller than what you need to meet your project objectives. Now with the real-time sampling techniques, using these detectors and platforms that were discussed in Module 1, you can be collecting a lot more readings and thus getting much more complete site coverage. Go to slide 38, please. And we're going to now talk about key acceptance issues and elements for using these technologies. Once again, the plug that we can't emphasize enough, the importance of developing and implementing a strong QAQC program. You want to meet your project's goals. You want to gain acceptance and buy-in from the regulatory agencies. Let's turn to slide 39. The requirements for data quality and measurement system performance are determined in the data quality objectives process, the DQO. So you're going to be figuring out issues such as identifying the RAD constituents of concern, minimum detectable concentrations to achieve reliability of measurements, allowable quantitative uncertainty in measurements, stars, bullets. Establish this beforehand. These are your essential performance requirements and characteristics. And the speaker notes associated with this slide have a pretty good list of performance requirements that include, you know, action levels, surrogates, interferences, and detector types. There are a number of considerations for soil conditions. I'm going to mention a couple briefly and refer you again to Chapter 6 of our document, as well as the speaker notes for the details. So please consider the surface conditions. Measurements are calibrated to a bare soil surface. Grass and non-woody vegetation don't have too much of an effect on measurements, but concrete or asphalt covering can have a large effect. Soil moisture needs to be considered. The water content of soil affects quantification. So, you know, you've got to take that into account. Soil surfaces need to be accessible so that your detector orientation approximates what you used in calibration. And the parent material also can have an effect. Certain shales will contribute to elevated levels of gamma. Now that last bullet, measurement considerations for contaminant distribution. Let me give you an example. In situ gamma measurements of REDS in soil are based on assuming uniform contaminant concentrations with soil depth. Practical application, that may not be what you have. And when contamination is concentrated in the top centimeter of soil, like a thin surface layer, the in situ measurements will be greater than if the constituents are uniformly distributed. We list other examples in the speaker notes, again referring you to the document. Go ahead, please, and turn to slide 40. Overall, what we're dealing with is the issue of error management. And a QAQC program is what we use to identify and manage error sources within acceptable tolerances. So we're going to briefly discuss each of the bullets that are listed on the next slides. Slide 41, please. But we're referring to calibration of the detector response to radionuclide concentration in soil. And there are two basic methods to initial setup and calibration. Point source involves using small standard sources placed at defined distances and angles relative to the detector crystal to characterize detector response. For the calibration pad method, a calibration pad is constructed using discrete sources or a uniformly distributed source in the calibration pad substrate, and that may be soil, concrete, or some other material. With data analysis and reduction, you're taking counts of either gross gamma or isotopic activity, converting to activity concentrations in soil, conversion equations, and the inputs needed to perform the calculations. And the bullets listed under that data analysis and reduction point relate to doing just that. Let's turn to slide 42, please. For continuing operations, what we're referring to are the checks and procedures to assure that the measurement systems are operating within acceptable limits. Lots more detail about these in the document. Slide 43, please. With data documentation and defensibility, your project will need to meet the requirements of the regulatory program that it's under. Typically, that program is CERCLA or Nuclear Regulatory Commission decommissioning. It can be corrective action also. And while the requirements are well established for the traditional sampling and analysis at a fixed lab, they're not as much so for real time. So please figure this out beforehand. And what we've found in our the experience on our team is that the protocols and requirements under CERCLA provide a good model for designing a defensible program. The Fernald, Ohio case study that Carl will discuss in Module 3 will show you some of the issues that state and federal regulators faced about producing defensible data and the QAQC program that was developed to address these issues. Let's turn to slide 44, please. And we're on our final element, chain of custody. Chain of custody is greatly reduced for real-time measurements. Fewer parties are involved in the collection, production, and processing of data, but you'll still be completing field logbooks and logging files in the data systems. What's critical is you need to maintain the integrity of the information from the point of collection to its eventual database archiving. And before we leave Module 2, let's quickly recap what we covered. We learned that there aren't as much institutional protocols and regulatory experience with real-time systems, so you need a rigorous QAQC program to meet your project's objectives and gain regulatory acceptance. We talked about different types of uncertainty, as well as dynamic work strategies. And lastly, we discussed how to design a QAQC program to establish system performance and validate and verify that system performance. And if we turn to slide 45, as you see, it's time for our first question and answer session. So, Juliana, back to you.
Thank you, Anne. We are going to take a break now to answer questions. And so for our simulcast audience, it's that orange question mark button that's going to allow you to send in a question. For our phone line audience, I do encourage you to ask your own question out loud. You are going to need to unmute your phone. That's *7 to unmute. I've blocked all the lines, so even if you didn't mute your phone, you need to select *7 to unmute, plus unmute on your phone itself. Do you have any questions from the phone line to start? It does take a few minutes for our simulcast questions to come in. So, again, if you are participating in the simulcast audience, it's the orange question mark that's going to allow you to type in your question. While we're waiting for our first question to come in, I would like to ask our instructors to tell us a little bit more about that upcoming training class, the one on decontamination and decommissioning. Can you tell us more about what's covered in that training class?
This is Carl Sprang. I can start. Again, that's tied to a document that the team produced, the latest document, about decommissioning and decontamination, decommissioning of radioactively contaminated sites. And again, these are a variety of sites. There's an emphasis because of our backgrounds on DOE sites, but other sites are included. There's a variety of regulatory frameworks that are covered that apply to these sites, and they're all covered and described, and technologies that have been applied at these various sites. Other elements of D&D, like cost and so forth, are also covered.
And another point that that's covered are there's two risk assessment tools that apply to rad-contaminated buildings as well as surfaces outside the buildings. So you'd be learning about EPA has these preliminary remediation goal calculators. Very, very useful for this kind of work.
I think what we try to cover all the issues that people have to consider when undergoing decontamination, decommissioning. We've got a section on regulatory issues, let's see, cost elements, health and safety issues, and then we've got a nice section on case studies, and then we also talk about case stakeholder concerns, and then lessons learned. So it's again, it's been another real popular training that we have, and then the document has been well received as well. So hopefully everybody can grab a copy of that.
As a reminder, that training class is offered on November 18 at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. You can go to the ITRC website to register. From our simulcast audience, Mike Logan at Ternex in Oklahoma City, what is used more, point source or calibration pad?
Carl, any thoughts on that one?
Well, I'm assuming point source. They're mobile, and there aren't that many calibration pads available to go to. The nearest one for us is in Grand Junction, Colorado, at the Department of Energy site there. So that would require quite a bit of travel to get to those calibration pads to do that. And there, and people do that, make that trip because they need to. But in the meantime, there are point sources that are used to handier and used in between calibration pad visits.
I would say point source as well. I know all of our instruments are calibrated with point source here in Oak Ridge.
Yeah, it's really probably focused a result of the scale of the project and how widely you're implementing the real-time project and how much site-specific concerns you have with regard to, like, soil type or something like that, and how much that is affected by daily weather events. So if you're doing a radium or a radon where radon daughters affect your response, then you may need that to account for that variability.
From Robert Nakamoto at the Division of Solid Waste in Tennessee, what kind of cost savings has been realized at the Fernald site versus the old monitoring methods?
Well, the only time it was actually quantified was by technology development money out of DOE did an assessment of it in the early days for characterization, and that's where they came up with a $15 million cost savings over top of over sampling fit with physical samples. I think that's way underestimated because the real cost, I think, is on the remediation side where you're basically digging layers of contaminated soil and you're using the real time to decide whether you keep going or you stop. And if you'd have to wait on the sample returns on each of those layers, that would take a lot of time, potentially a week or more for real time turn depending on what you're sampling for. or for a lab return, depending on what you're sampling for. And during that time, you have this, the equipment and the operator sitting around not working probably, and or working less or operating much less efficiently. And that's where real cost savings comes in. It's probably not on the characterization side, or, and I would argue probably not even on the final certification side, but it's really on the driving that excavation so it doesn't stop kind of deal. That's where the real money's saved. And those were not calculated or documented well.
So I'm John Carson at Shar Environmental in Ohio. What tools are useful for accurate location and positioning inside a building?
Ooh. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know whether you guys don't talk about that during the D&D training at all, do you? I'm not even sure it's in the D&D document.
I would say, depending on the size of the building and, you know, if you're having to go around equipment, I would almost say handheld instruments are still going to be better in a building.
Yeah, it's talking about locational data, though, not the concentration data, I believe was the question.
Locational?
And that's going to, I got to assume some kind of laser grid would probably be the most effective at locational stuff. But I haven't dealt with trying to do it inside of a building off a grid survey, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the best is out there on that.
I'm not sure either, but I think that's right. A laser grid inside a building tied to a GPS point outside the building.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question that refers to slide 28. So if you're in the clue in, you can look to the left, and there's a list of slide numbers, and you can jump quickly to slide 28. From Steve Merritt at Region 8 Emergency Response Unit in Denver, Colorado, where can I find more information about the capabilities, limitations, and cost information of the real-time measurement systems that are listed on slide 28?
There should be some information in our books, but I forget now. I think at one point we had contractors that we could contact with each of these instruments and get further information.
Yeah, the one point to make is that this document was written a few years ago, and these businesses tend to change names and who's vendoring them pretty frequently. So finding these specific monitors out there, I'm not sure who's vendoring them at the moment. I do know that DOE had done some cost stuff out of their Office of Technology Development, but that's been eliminated, and I'm not sure, and that was a number of years ago too, done out of Oak Ridge, or Argonne, I think maybe did that. But I'm not sure that there's anything out there on currently available, cost analysis of side-by-sides from an independent party. I think you'd have to go to the various vendors and see who's selling what these days and assess it from that aspect.
Some of these are developed by vendors, as Tom said. Some have been developed at DOE National Labs and so forth, so there's a variety of entities that put these systems and platforms together.
I have a comment from our simulcast participant, Gary Della Guardia at Malcolm Perney in Denver. He says that they use laser positioning systems inside the building, related to an earlier question.
Thank you, Gary.
Nice to have that corroborated.
From Sai Apaji, EPA in Dallas, are the detectors used in real-time measurement techniques comparable to traditional lab detection limits?
I think yes. There was a number of studies at the Fernald Project doing comparisons between lab data and the real-time instruments. The issue at hand, though, is the view range of the detector. And so the detector is seeing a big area. So it's really the size of the area seen. At Fernald, they did a number of different analysis where they went out and basically collected physical samples within the viewing area of, say, the HBGE detector, and averaged those samples to come up with the number that the detector would be seeing, and they had a very good correlation of that data.
Did a similar study at Rocky Flats to do the same thing, and again, a good correlation. The lab studies, or one reason the lab cost more and takes longer is that they detect those for 2 weeks and sometimes even more to get a very accurate count. But again, I've seen several studies that show very good correlation between in situ and ex situ measurements.
A question from John Carson at Shaw Environmental in Ohio. How do you adapt the RTM methodology to irregular surfaces?
Well, RTM, I think that's the
real-time measurement.
Okay, yeah. It's basically depending on the detector. Some of them, like the sodium iodide, they would be mounted on a wheeled vehicle, and that vehicle would navigate the terrain, and basically it most of the time keep the detector parallel to the surface. Another example they used at Fernald is that one that's on the end of a track hoe, basically, and you can lower it down into an excavation to see the wall of the excavation. And so basically you have to put the detector into a configuration to be looking perpendicular to the surface.
I don't know if calculations to correct for a very irregular surface, but the assumption when you're making those measurements is a planar surface, and which is, of course, not always the case.
Right.
But so there'll be some minor... some minor variations, but for most purposes, it's minor enough that the readings are still good.
And a lot of that's addressed by the overlapping readings. So if you're doing 100% coverage, in most cases, the views are overlapping over top of a given point multiple times in your passes, so that if you're either using HPGE and dropping circles, or you're using sodium iodide and dropping basically rectangles, those rectangles are overlap as well as the circles if you're doing 100% coverage, which is what you do in most cases.
Currently, the measurements were taken at about 18, I think, supposed to be 18 inches to 24 inches. And as Tom had said, if it's an irregular, like you're doing trenches, in that case, you might want to use something like the EMS, the system, where you actually are allowed to drop that into the trench to get a more accurate reading.
Thank you, instructors. We do need to wrap up this question and answer break, and we'll have more time at the end for questions. So if everyone can put your phone back on mute, or everyone but Carl, and we'll turn to slide 46 and continue with the second half of today's training class. I'll turn the presentation over to Carl Spring of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Carl?
Thanks, Juliana. So far, we've discussed how some of the instruments work that are typically used for real-time RAD surveys. That was Robert in the first module. And then we've also talked in the last module about the data collection approaches that make real-time surveys more effective and about the role data quality and uncertainty play. And we're now going to talk about how these systems and approaches have been used at several radioactively contaminated sites. You can find more details from the case studies in Appendix E of the ITRC document, the hard copy. If you'll go to the next slide, 47. Now, in this module, we'll discuss how the instruments and methodologies we've talked about previously have been applied at a variety of sites for both surface surveys and in the subsurface. We'll talk about some of the advantages of using these methods and also some of the limitations, that is, where it's appropriate to use real-time surveys and where it's not. The next slide, 48. The ITRC document has several case studies of a variety of sites across the country, and many of them are part of the DOE nuclear weapons complex. The use of real-time gamma systems to support soil remediation, that's a significant departure from the conventional approach used previously at radiologically contaminated sites. This departure is, we feel, warranted by the large scale of many of the federal cleanup sites coming into the CERCLA program in recent decades, and also by the associated characterization costs and the need to contain cleanup times. If you go to the next slide, 49, you'll see the four sites that we've selected for this training. And three of them demonstrate aspects of surface soil surveys. That's the Mount Pleasant, Fernald, and Rocky Flats studies. And the Savannah Riverside case study is an example of a subsurface survey. So first of all, the Mount Pleasant site, beginning on slide 50. This is a NORM site in Michigan. NORM is a ubiquitous problem for the oil and gas industry. NORM is the acronym for Naturally Occurring Radioactive Materials. And that designator is used to differentiate it from other sites that are contaminated with man-made radioactivity. For this industry, NORM problems usually mean elevated levels of radium-226 and or radium-228. These radionuclides can be found at elevated levels at a variety of oil and gas industry waste streams, including sludge and pipe scale. Activity concentrations for individual pieces of scale could reach tens of thousands of picocuries per gram. This Mount Pleasant site is a privately owned pipe storage yard, or it was, in central Michigan. The pipes were salvaged from producing wells throughout the state, and they were brought to this 3-acre pipe yard for cleaning, reconditioning, and storage. And as is typical at pipe yards, these pipes were stored on racks. The scale that had formed on the outside of the pipes while they were installed in wells fell off the pipes during handling and through exposure to the elements. Both the operators of the wells from which the pipes were pulled and the owner of the pipe yard weren't aware at first of the radioactivity of the scale. And as a result, radioactive scale was distributed across the pipe yard, contaminating the surface soils. On slide 51, you can see a picture of a chip of NORM contaminated scale on a shovel that's typical of the NORM scale found in the surface soils of the site. And this form of contamination tends to be extremely localized and variable. Now, back in 1991, the site owner conducted a site survey and determined that portions of the site had elevated surficial gamma activity. The owner excavated about 38 yards of contaminated soils that were identified by gross gamma activity. These soils easily ranged into the thousands of picocuries per gram for radium-226. And after the excavation work, the remaining pipe was removed from the yard. Then later in 1997, the state of Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality performed a cursory site survey and identified additional locations on site where elevated gamma activity was present. The agency also sampled soils from the stored drums and found radium concentrations that ranged from 1 up to 3,000 picocuries per gram. And after the state's 1997 survey, the owner expressed interest in being able to sell the property at some point, and so contamination of the site needed to be cleaned up to be in compliance with the state of Michigan regulations for unrestricted use. Future plans for the site included potential conversion into residential housing units. The strategy developed for the site was based on real-time measurement technologies and a dynamic work plan to support soil and drum characterization. MARSIM, the multi-agency system that Ann talked about, that was used for a final closure compliance demonstration. If you go to the next slide, 52, various real-time technologies were used to provide characterization information for the site. These included a small sodium iodide instrument. It's called a mini fiddler, and the fiddler is an acronym for Field Instrument for Detecting Low Energy Radiation. And also an in-situ sodium iodide gamma spectroscope system and an in-situ HPGE gamma spectroscope system, and finally an off-site gamma spectroscope. The mini fiddler system was coupled with a differential GPS and a data logger, and it measured and recorded gross activity readings from surficial soils with one measurement every 2 seconds. The system was deployed in a walkover mode with the technician walking parallel lines, and you can kind of see those parallel lines in on the map that's displayed on this slide. So the technician walk these parallel lines to provide a complete coverage of the exposed soil surfaces. The log data were offloaded, then mapped and analyzed using a geographical information system. The in-situ sodium iodide gamma spectroscopic system used was a low-cost commercial system developed specifically for radium-226 applications. The in-situ HPGE system also provided accurate activity concentrations for radium. Even though it's significantly more expensive and difficult to operate than the sodium iodide gamma spectroscopic system, the HPGE had the advantage of providing activity concentration estimates for radium-226 that could not be affected by the potential presence of other elevated radionuclides. The in-situ HPGE system was primarily used as a verification tool. An initial walk over the site was conducted to map spatial patterns of contamination. The mini fiddler found elevated readings sprinkled across most of the site, and based on this walkover, 50 locations with elevated readings were selected and measured using the in-situ sodium iodide gamma spectroscopic system. This scan used a 5-foot spacing between walked lines. Data was collected in 2-second intervals, which resulted in approximately a 3-foot spacing between data points. The data were downloaded to a laptop on site and then mapped using ArcView software. The data were color-coded based on observed gross activity, and in a couple of instances, small areas were rewalked to ensure that coverage of the site was adequate. Now, if you'll turn then to the next slide, slide 53, both the mini fiddler and in-situ sodium iodide gamma spectroscopic system showed excellent performance at the site. In this slide, you see the final survey done after excavation. A display of the discretely collected measurements is on the left, and then on the right, those measurements have been spatially averaged. The real-time measurement systems provided data at a fraction of the cost of standard laboratory gamma spectroscopy analyses. The per-measurement cost of each mini-fiddler data point was on the order of a few pennies, and the deployment of the in-situ sodium iodide gamma spectroscopic system cost approximately $10 per measurement. In contrast, the cost of collecting and analyzing a soil sample via gamma spectroscopy at an off-site laboratory is several hundred dollars. So the conclusion is that the deployment of these real-time technologies for this particular site filled the data collection needs at a fraction of the cost of a more traditional data collection program, with a greater reduction in the degree of uncertainty associated with the closure survey of the site. For this particular site, the field work associated with characterization, remediation, and closure was only a few days. Including real-time data collection in the closure program ensured that demobilization could occur with the assurance that the entire site met the Department of Environmental Quality's closure standards. Aside from data collection costs and time savings, the primary benefit of deploying a triad style, that is real-time data collection program at the site, was the ability to roll characterization, remediation, and closure into one round of field work. And for this particular site, that took only a few days. Now on the next slide, 54, we list some observations and lessons that we can learn from the experience at this Mount Pleasant site. First, systematic planning must be used when deploying multiple technologies as part of remediation and closure. Decision makers and regulators have to understand and concur on how technologies will be used and the contingency plans that will be used in the event that one or more of the technologies doesn't meet expectations. Next, it's important to build performance validation and verification studies into the overall data collection strategy for a site if real-time measurement systems are going to be used. Next, assuming that project-specific performance goals are met, real-time data collection can be used for site closure data requirements much more efficiently than standard samples for laboratory analysis. And last, one of the key benefits of the triad approach to characterization and remediation is the ability to design fieldwork that integrates characterization, remediation, and closure into one effort. And this ability reduces schedules as well as overall project costs. Now, slide 55, we move to the Fernald Environmental Management Project in Ohio. And this is one of the first DOE cleanup projects to use real-time measurement systems as the primary measurement system supporting cleanup. The site committed early on to the use of innovative in-situ gamma spectrometry systems to support soil remediation projects. And you'll remember back in slides 9 and 12, you can see some before and after pictures of the Fernald site. Slide 9, I believe, was the site during active remediation, and then slide 12 after remediation was complete. The soils project at Fernald covered over 1,000 acres of soils, which were impacted to various degrees by several below-ground waste disposal units. Radioactive contaminants of concern at this site included thorium, radium, and uranium. And the picture here in this slide is from the top of the on-site disposal facility. Slide 56. The capabilities of the technologies and the numbers and types of platforms in which they are deployed underwent continuous improvement and expansion from the beginning of the project. Two of the real-time measurement systems used at Fernald consisted of mobile platforms employing large sodium iodide detectors. And by large, we mean 4 inch by 4 inch by 16 inch detectors. And they use those along with triad-mounted HPGE detectors. The mobile sodium iodide systems employ GPS position tracking systems and data telemetry systems to perform full coverage surface soil surveys, primarily for the purpose of identifying areas of elevated levels of gamma-emitting radionuclides. Except for confirmatory sampling for final certification, these real-time systems have replaced all physical sampling for waste acceptance criteria and hotspot identification. Now, the next slide, 57, Ann had mentioned talking about regulatory issues in this Fernald case study. Real-time gamma systems were approved for use in almost all aspects of soil remediation at Fernald. The three main phases of remediation are pre-design of excavations, excavation support, and pre-certification. The pre-design involves determining the excavation boundaries of the soils above remediation levels, including the separate delineation of soils in excess of waste acceptance criteria for the on-site disposal facility. Excavation support involves lift-by-lift characterization of soil surfaces, while pre-certification determines that an area is free of hotspots and has average soil contamination levels below cleanup levels. The main exception was for use in final certification of remediation areas where physical samples are required. Now, in response to the proposed use of these technologies, Ohio EPA and U.S. EPA raised a number of technical issues related to producing data of known and defensible quality. Some of the primary concerns specific to real-time data, gamma measurements are, number one, undocumented data quality, two, uncontrolled environmental conditions, three, in-situ definition of a sample, that is, what does a sample constitute in this context, and fourth, differences between measurement and calibration soil conditions. Turn next to slide 58. Here's some of the conclusions from the Fernald site. Extensive studies were conducted on the HPGE systems in an attempt to have the systems approved for use in performing final certification of remediation areas. If you remember, that's the one area that where physical samples were required. The results of the studies established that individual HPGE measurements of a contamination area produced very comparable results to a weighted average of physical samples taken over the field of view of the in-situ measurement, and Tom referred to those earlier, that comparison between HPGE measurements and physical samples, an array of physical samples. On the basis of the studies performed, Fernald concluded that the HPGE systems were capable of achieving the data quality necessary for final certification of remediation areas when using proper controls. Regulators, however, continued to cite concerns for perceived low bias from radon emanation, as well as concerns for making accurate soil moisture measurements with field instruments. So they ultimately disapproved the use of HPGE for making radium-226 final certification measurements. Because there would have been little economic benefit to using HPGE for final certification of total uranium and thorium-232 alone, when laboratory measurements would have to be made for radium-226, DOE at Fernald conceded to use laboratory analysis for final certification for all three of these primary radiological contaminants of concern. Also, most certification sampling includes collecting physical samples for other inorganic contaminants anyway, so the benefit of using HPGE for certification is reduced. The greatest savings are achieved in surveys to detect elevated areas and in the delineation of excavation areas. And you've heard a couple times, Tom's mentioned that earlier, that it was estimated that $15 million were saved in characterization costs alone, and that probably represents a small fraction of the total savings. And these types of uses have been approved and strongly supported by Ohio EPA and US EPA. Now, in slide 59, we'll go to another site, that is Rocky Flats in Colorado. And Rocky Flats is a former nuclear weapons component manufacturing complex where I spent the past about 16 years or so as in a regulatory oversight role. This site sits on a 10-mile square area northwest of Denver. And active remediation was completed in October 2005, and over the next year and a half, the site completed all of the closure paperwork and negotiated the post-closure agreement. And so now we're looking at maintenance and monitoring, and actually there's more of both of those than I would have expected. This case study was selected to demonstrate two aspects. First of all, one that we've mentioned, utilizing gamma-emitting surrogates for alpha emitters, and then second, an example of aerial surveys. In this picture, you'll notice a white square in the middle of the upper left photo. That's the 903 pad drum storage area. That's a 3.5-acre area where drums containing radiologically contaminated oils and volatile organic compounds were stored from 1958 through 1967. And that's when cleanup operations began in 67. And there were more, at that time, more than 5,000 drums at the site. About 450 of those drums had leaked to some degree, and an estimated 50 drums had leaked their entire contents. The total amount of leaked material was estimated at around 5,000 gallons of contaminated liquid containing approximately 86 grams of plutonium. That's about 5.3 curies. And during drum removal and cleanup activities, wind and rain spread plutonium-contaminated soils, and that resulted in a widespread superficial soil contamination east of the 903 pad. If you'll turn with me to slide 60. The remediation of radiologically contaminated areas at the Rocky Flats site was triggered by comparing measured radioactivity levels to action levels established for the radionuclides of concern, and those are plutonium, americium, and uranium. But since plutonium is the contaminant of greatest concern, an efficient method of measuring plutonium activity is critical. Plutonium, however, is a weak gamma emitter. Its gamma emissions are generally undetectable at the low activity levels that are common cleanup goals. Alpha spectrometry results normally take at least 7 days, much too long for an efficient decision-making process during remedial activities. So, plutonium plutonium activity levels for soils in certain areas were determined by measuring americium gamma emissions as a surrogate, providing a real-time measurement technique for plutonium. Rocky Flats weapons-grade plutonium was formulated with a known mass fraction of isotopes, that is, the isotopic mixture by mass, back when it was produced. So each isotope has a unique specific gravity. The specific activity, and that means the activity of gram per isotope that's associated with it. And that allows the activity fraction of each isotope in weapons-grade plutonium to be calculated. If you'll turn to slide 61, it's evident that over time the proportional amount of americium-241 and plutonium-239 increases in the mixture relative to the other isotopes. Because radioactive decay rates are constant for all of these isotopes, it's possible to determine the exact amount of each isotope that is decayed, or in this case, the exact amount of relative mass fraction for each isotope, that is, the remaining amount of each isotope. Based on the new calculated mass fraction of each isotope for the given time period, the activity fraction is calculated. So over time, and it's 34 years in this case, the isotope in the mixture decayed, thus changing the mass fraction of each isotope, and in turn, the activity fraction. The calculated results at the time of production, that is year zero, and after 34 years of radioactive decay are shown in this table. The plutonium-239 activity fraction increases because the plutonium-239 mass in the mixture decays more slowly than the other isotopes. The americium-241 activity fraction increases because the americium-241 mass in the mixture increases due to the decay of the other isotopes into americium-241. We call that americium-241 ingrowth. For 34-year-old weapons-grade plutonium, the ratio of the plutonium-239 activity fraction is shown here as 37.5%, and the americium-241 activity fraction, again, we can see that's 6.61%. That ratio is 5.7 to 1. This calculated ratio and the associated activity fractions are widely accepted at Rocky Flats and throughout the DOE weapons complex because they can be precisely calculated. The plutonium to americium ratio can also be used to determine plutonium-239 activity for soils from the measured americium-241 activity. This concept has been applied during the excavation of the 903 pad to see, or to allow near real-time measurements and facilitate decision-making in the field. Several factors support using the theoretical plutonium to americium ratio of 5.7 to 1. First of all, a linear regression analysis of data from over 400 sample locations in the 903 pad area produced essentially the same ratio as the theoretical weapons grade ratio. And two, process knowledge indicates that only weapons grade plutonium was released at the 903 pad site. Three, it's believed that the plutonium released at the 903 pad was all manufactured at about the same time. Four, due to isotopic decay and the half-life of the radionuclides involved, activities do not change significantly from year to year. Five, the physical and chemical similarities of the isotopes of concern are not expected to contribute to varying transport mechanisms that would cause isotopic separation in the environment. Six, the use of actual known weapons-grade isotopic mixture avoids the uncertainties in analytical methods. Now, if you'll turn to the next slide, 62. During the removal action at the 903 pad, composite conformation samples were collected from each excavation cell, which provided a sufficient number of samples to achieve greater than a 90% confidence in decisions. These samples were analyzed with gamma spectroscopy, that is, with high-purity germanium detectors in the field. And the quick turnaround time for gamma spectroscopy field results, which are about 10 minutes, allowed project managers to decide in the field whether further excavation was necessary. The samples were then sent to an on-site lab for preliminary, that is about 6 hours, and then final, within a day, gamma spectroscopic analysis, and then they were retained for an off-site lab for alpha spectroscopy, and that takes at least a week. So the regulatory agencies, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment and US EPA Region 8, require, as they did at Fernald, require validated alpha spectroscopy data for final confirmation. The plutonium to americium ratio at certain other sites around Rocky Flats, however, is somewhat different. In some areas, very different ratios were created by processes which preferentially extracted americium. There, the americium surrogate technique can't be used, where the americium to or the plutonium to americium ratio has not been verified. The next slide, 63, takes us to the other topic at Rocky Flats, aircraft-mounted detector systems. A final radiological survey was conducted at Rocky Flats to confirm that all significant areas of surface soil contamination were identified. The entire site was wide area scanned using a helicopter-mounted detector system. Also, localized ground-based scanning was performed in areas with a higher potential for contamination to verify that small areas of surface soil contamination had not been overlooked. These localized areas were primarily around remediated areas where contamination was once known to exist, and in selected areas where wide area scanning could not be performed, and for any areas that exceeded the minimum detectable activity of the wide area scan. An array of 12 2-inch by 4-inch by 16-inch thallium-activated sodium iodide scintillation detectors were mounted on the helicopter. The survey was performed at an altitude of 15 meters with a ground speed of 70 knots, and that's about 80 miles an hour. The aircraft was equipped with a differential global positioning system and a radar altimeter. Radiation, that is full energy spectra, and positional information is collected each second and displayed in real time. Gamma ray spectra, the aircraft position, meteorological parameters, and time are all archived. The next slide, 64. The effective detector footprints, a complex function of detector shape, and distance from the source, air mass attenuation, aircraft speed, and so forth. However, for estimation purposes, the footprint radius is approximately the same as the detector distance above the source. So the detector field of view footprint is approximately 700 square meters. Therefore, flight lines 30 meters apart will provide complete coverage. The detector reports the average activity within its footprint. The plutonium concentration is determined by multiplying the americium 241 concentration in picocuries per gram by 5.7. That's the conversion factor from the graph that we saw earlier, from the chart, and which is based on the calculated plutonium to americium ratio in weapons grade plutonium. Uranium-234 activity is approximated based on the uranium-235 and uranium-238 activity detected. This approximation is reasonable for depleted and natural uranium. However, if enriched uranium is identified, as evidenced by elevated uranium-235 proportionate to uranium-238, then the method detection activity for uranium-234 is no longer valid. Uranium-238 values then are inferred based on thorium-234 measurements. Now, while the regulators at Rocky Flats based final confirmation evaluations based primarily on lab-analyzed soil samples, they considered this real-time scanning system an important supplement. These scanning techniques ensure 100% coverage of soil, surface soils, and they're capable of detecting concentrations below action levels within areas much smaller than accepted exposure unit sizes. In the next slide, we'll go to the Savannah River site in South Carolina. The Savannah River site is a DOE site near Aiken, South Carolina. It was constructed during the early 1950s to produce tritium and plutonium-239 in support of national defense programs. This case study describes the use of the spectral gamma probe, which is an instrument designed to measure radioactivity levels in the subsurface. We'll talk about the advantage of using cone penetrometer technologies, including cost, and we'll also discuss how the field testing results compare with physical sampling baseline methods. So let's go to slide 66. In 1957, a fuel element failure in the reactor disassembly basin resulted in the discharge of approximately 2,700 curies of radioactivity into basin 1, with overflow going into the other basins. As part of the in-situ detection of radionuclides in 1997, a spectral gamma probe developed by the Army Corps of Engineers was evaluated for site characterization at the R reactor seepage basins. The probe was deployed in 3 of the 6 seepage basins that were constructed and operated between 1957 and 1964. Now, limited technologies are currently available for in-situ subsurface measurements of radionuclides. The baseline method for radiological measurements of contaminated sediments requires the use of cone penetrometer technology or drilling rigs to collect samples for field or laboratory analysis. Collecting physical samples provides a high degree of precision and accuracy, but it's extremely costly and presents numerous risks associated with handling of the highly radioactive samples. Since the distribution of subsurface contamination is not homogeneous at most waste sites, a large number of samples typically are required to accurately delineate the extent of contamination. Due to the high cost per sample with the baseline method, budget constraints often limit the number of samples collected and analyzed. In many cases, this may result in inadequate site characterization, potentially leading to suboptimal remedies. In slide 67, a picture of the spectral gamma probe assembly, and it consists of a truck-mounted gamma radiation detection system. The sensor detects gamma radiation emitted by the radioactive waste, and the energy spectrum is analyzed to identify radioactive constituents and their relative concentrations. The probe's downhole system consists of a detector containing a 1-inch by 3-inch cylindrical sodium iodide crystal and a photomultiplier tube, along with a temperature sensor and a custom-designed preamplifier. Specialized software has improved identification and quantification of the isotopes and also creates a data display in real time when the push is in progress. Now, if you go with me to the next slide, number 68. For site characterization, the probe is driven into the subsurface using these SCAPs, or a cone penetrometer truck. As the cone penetrometer rods advance into the ground, the probe transmits analog signals that are recorded in the data acquisition system. As the rods are retracted, grouts injected to fully seal the hole. To prevent contamination of the truck during testing, soil sample rods are decontaminated using a decontamination chamber below the, it's attached below the truck. In this case, decontamination consists of a plastic blast system, similar to sandblasting with small plastic beads to remove soil from the rods. For the details of the spectral gamma probe are in Appendix G of the document. You'll now go to the next slide, 69. The spectral gamma probe was tested at the Savannah River site in 1997. The specific objective of this testing was to assess its capability to accurately measure cesium-137 contamination in the subsurface. The data gathered with the spectral gamma probe was compared with laboratory data from soil samples sent to on-site laboratories. These soil samples were taken by a hand auger in 2-foot increments and composited for analysis to eliminate potential variations. The sampling interval for the gamma probe varied from 3-inch to 1-foot intervals. In each of the 3 basins, the 3 gamma probe pushes were clustered around a hand-augered sample collection location. The laboratory determined radius of influence for the gamma probe was 8 inches. So it could see 8 inches into the subsurface material. The in-situ measurements made with the spectral gamma probe were found to be comparable to the laboratory measurements of the core samples. Analysis of the data indicates that the spectral gamma probe provides a more detailed profile of the contamination than the baseline methods. And you can see that on this graphic display. The peaks of the activity generally fell within the laboratory measured peaks of activity. The gamma probe also was able to detect areas of activity not identified by the grosser sampling method used for the laboratory analysis. Now, the next slide, 70, we'll talk about some of the limitations of this system. At basins 1 and 3, the lower limit of detection for cesium-137 appears to have been approximately 5 picocuries per gram, and weaker gamma emitters had higher detection limits. In basin 3, the cesium-137 level was calculated at 1 picocurie per gram. While this value corresponds with laboratory data, additional testing is needed to define the lower limit of detection for cesium-137 and other radioisotopes. In addition, the density and moisture content of the soil also affected the detection limit. Another point is that contamination in a few areas within Basin 1 and Basin 3 exceeded the dynamic range of the sensor designed for detection of low-level activities. In addition, an extremely high gross count rate was also noted due to the presence of high levels of strontium and other beta emitters. The next point, the use of the spectral gamma probe is currently limited to sites where a cone penetrometer can penetrate down to the desired subsurface depths. However, deep subsurface contamination is greater than 50 meters, and rocky geologic strata restrict its use. Another point is that there's a wide variation in contaminant levels at some radioactive sites that can present problems for quantitative analyses. The system used at Savannah Riverside was optimized to measure very low levels of contamination and calibrated according to its performance specification. But locations with high radiation levels require significant post-measurement corrections. And the last point is that the sodium iodide detector used in the gamma probe has relatively high detection efficiency, but relatively poor energy resolution. Also, its output varies with temperature, and as a result, resolution of gamma ray peaks is difficult where signal-to-background ratios are relatively low. Compared to sodium iodide detectors, HPGE detectors offer higher resolution. However, these detectors require cooling to liquid nitrogen temperatures for downhole applications, and that potentially adds to the cost. Now, if you turn to slide 71, at the Savannah River site, the spectral gamma probe system offered numerous comparative advantages over the baseline approach. First of all, use of cone penetrometer technologies provides a significant reduction in the secondary waste handling requirements. For instance, at the R reactor seepage basin demonstration, the number of waste drums was reduced to 1, compared to 7 generated during the drilling activities. Also, in-situ measurements eliminate the need for sample collection, transport, and analysis. So all those various points that where people can come in contact with contaminated samples. And that's the next point. The use of the spectral gamma probe significantly reduces the risk of worker exposure to hazardous conditions by eliminating the need for collection and shipment and analyses of the samples. The more rapid data collection also reduces the length of workers' exposure to hazardous materials. A decontamination system used for the rod system performed well, so the workers only had to use modified level D protection, which saved both time and cost. The next point is that the use of the spectral gamma probe system also minimizes potential environmental impacts because drill cuttings or secondary waste is virtually eliminated. The small diameter penetrometer holes can be sealed during retraction of the rods, and the spectral gamma system can be easily decontaminated. The probe also requires less stringent permits compared to those needed for drilling and sample collection because the investigation-derived waste are significantly minimized. And a last point is that in-situ soil characterization techniques for specific radionuclides offer significant cost reduction potential as compared to the baseline practice of sample collection and laboratory analysis. At Savannah Riverside, these included, first of all, $800,000 in actual cost savings at this demonstration that we talked about. And secondly, low measurement cost of about $3,500 per sample compared with almost $8,000 for the baseline measurement. And last, overall better economics than when more than 30-35 samples for characterization were collected. Now that was the end of a very long module, and we'll turn the microphone over to Tom for the final wrap-up of this training.
Thanks, Carl, and if you'll all move forward to slide 73, we'll get started wrapping up the conclusions and observations portions of the training. In this section, we're going to cover the three categories of observations and some conclusions that summarize what's in the real-time technology document that we've published and we've talked about today. You can see the three types of observations: general, technical, and regulatory and stakeholder, where we talk a little bit about the acceptance issues. Moving on to slide 74, some general observations with regard to real-time technologies and limitations and benefits. It's important to have a good understanding of the physics and characteristics of your site before using these technologies, and a good technology necessitates a good technical team to implement and evaluate and respond to the data. The data has to be evaluated in the context of the site and other information. Having a good understanding of your site is going to be essential to understanding the outcome of your real-time analysis. And having a team that understands the limitations of those real-time analysis and the site history is important to both understanding the data and acting appropriately in response to the data. Moving on to slide number 75, three types of uncertainty affect decisions. That's inferential uncertainty, analytical uncertainty, and spatial uncertainty. Basically, your analytical and then the data, how it's laid out on your site relative to the spots you don't see. And good QA/QC can help reduce a lot of those uncertainties, in addition to multiple data points in order to reduce that spatial uncertainty. And that's one of the big benefits of real-time technology is that you can get a lot more data points over an area to make sure that you don't miss things. But it's essential that you have a rigorous protocol that's mostly site-specific to ensure various parameters that will affect the data are accounted for. So having those site-specific protocols and making sure they're well-documented and followed is essential to getting data that you can draw good conclusions about. And those things like soil type, moisture, geometry affect those measurements, and you need to be aware of that and address them in your actions with regard to the data. Let's move on to slide 76. Stakeholder and regulator observations. It's as we all know, as regulators, it's important to be involved early on in the process where you decide to use this technology. It's also important to have the stakeholders involved early on. In general, they will be supportive of the idea because basically all of the sites looked at, and that's one of the strongest selling points to the public on real time is that in most cases you can get nearly 100% coverage of the site versus some number of samples over a pretty large area by standard statistical analysis with physical samples. Of course, QA/QC is something that's going to be paramount to both groups. It's something that the regulators are very concerned about in order to get good data, and it's something that the public's interested as well when they're comparing these kind of measurements to those from a lab where they typically believe that good data comes out of. And obviously, without good QA/QC, it's just a bunch of numbers, and it really doesn't mean anything. That QA/QC is going to be essential to getting data that's useful and accurate. There were early concerns at Pernod regarding certification. Most of those became mute because of the fact that we are going to have physical samples at the locations anyway for inorganic metals and other and some of the radionuclides that couldn't be detected. If it was just radionuclides, we'd probably support the use of it for certification, or at least for getting close to it. But in reality, the real cost savings doesn't come from certification. I strongly believe it's during the excavation process, like I talked about earlier in the training. Let's move on to slide 77. These technologies can allow us to rapidly measure a lot of different parameters in situ and basically respond to those and act appropriately, take appropriate remedial actions based on those data. We can look at most gamma-emitting radionuclides and even some that don't emit them based on their progeny. There are lots of vendors out there offering these systems now. Those vendors do change names like we talked a bit about, and these systems are able to be mounted on various platforms to access various different areas. And you can see cost savings reductions both in analytical cost reduction, secondary waste like Carl talked about, and then fast turnaround time and fast action in the site. Move on to slide 78. We think that these technologies provide a real opportunity for risk reduction, and that's multiple different kinds of risk. One is decision-making risk, and two is worker risk, and three is environmental protection risks. You can reduce your uncertainty about your decisions and thus your cost risk, and you have workers not exposed to soils. They're not out there collecting a soil sample. They're using a detector to run over top of the soils and get quicker results. You see the answer much quicker rather than having been exposed to it and find out a few weeks later about the data. And you get greater risk reduction and environmental protection because you have a much better chance of finding all the contamination than you do with a grid sampling approach. So we'll move on to slide 7. This is where we can move on to Juliana for the wrap-up and the final question and answer period. So, Juliana, on to you.
Thank you, Tom. On slide 79, before we get to the questions, let's go to the links to additional resources page. So if you select that area of the slide, that's going to bring up the links page for today's training class. And we've listed the web address of this links page on the slide itself because this is going to continue to be available as a resource for you. The first link I want to point out is how to get to the feedback. So if you look to the left, under that clue and sum, the third item down is the feedback. That's going to take you to our feedback form, and we would appreciate if everyone on the call today took a few minutes to fill out that feedback. We use the information you provide and really appreciate it if you just take a few minutes to fill out that form. Looking to the right in section one, the ITRC specific links, download today's ITRC training is going to allow you to download a PowerPoint version of today's training slides. In addition to what you've seen on the slides themselves during today's training class, more information is available in the speaker's notes section. The next item listed is the real-time measurements of radionuclides in soil, technologies and case studies, the RAD-4 document. That link is going to take you over to the ITRC website where you can download a PDF of the document. We're actually out of hard copies of the document, but if you'd like, you can order a CD with the document on it. That same page also allows you to order the D&D document that the team has developed, as well as download copies of the other documents available from the ITRC RADS team. We've also mentioned other internet-based training classes, and we have a link in Section 1 to that as well. In Section 2, we have some documents. In Section 3, websites. These are available as a resource for you. We do want to get to questions from our audience. So for our simulcast audience, it's back on the slides and then that question mark button that's going to allow you to send in a question. And phone line participants, you are welcome to ask your own questions out loud, and you just need to unmute your phone, and that's *7 to unmute your line. So you have to select *7, unmute your phone if you have it muted at your location to ask a question. Do we have a question to start with from our phone line audience?
Yes. I am calling from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and on the slide 75, the bottom has been mentioned about the geometric difference, And when the radionuclide emission come out, suppose it's a 136 degree, and the gamma radiation is very high, transparent, low energy, but high transparent. So the soil type and the moisture and the distance of the monitor, suppose is not as much impact as another kind of radionuclide. So the how much difference between the nearby the surface and the 1 foot ahead above, this kind of measurement, how much loss detective capability of this kind of gamma radiation monitor.
I think it is going to be dependent on the particular gamma emitter, gamma emission. But in general, it will not see 1 foot deep. I don't think most of this is targeted at surface soils, and unless you had a very high concentration and a strong gamma like you talked about, it probably won't make it to be seen by the detector.
I see.
It sees at pretty shallow depth.
Typically 6 inches or less, but certainly less than a foot.
This kind of monitor, how many species can detect it normally in the field operation? Talk about a different window, different energy. At the same time, how many species of the gamma radiation can be monitored?
Well, it depends on which monitor, whether it's sodium iodide or high-purity germanium detector, but I think high-purity germanium detector can see multiples at the same time. And sodium iodide requires a collimator, is that the right word, Robert?
To distinguish,
to distinguish the energies.
This seminar, the QAQC is the best. Much improved than previous,
Thank you.
Very, very good seminar. Yeah.
Thank you.
A simulcast question from Nylea Parker at Noblis Engineering in Prague, Czech Republic. Would you further explain the source of the contaminated pipe scale?
The pipe scale is naturally occurring radioactivity that accumulated on the sides of oil and gas well pipes that were, in some cases thousands of feet underground, accumulated during production of oil and gas. And it accumulates, in this case, mostly on the outside, but it also accumulates on the inside of pipes.
Yeah, I don't think it's that uncommon in the oil and gas industry to have those accumulations.
No.
From Hugh Nogue at U.S. EPA Region 3 in Philadelphia, concerning the Mount Pleasant site, what regulatory mechanism was used to determine the cleanup standard of the site? Also, for locations where soil was excavated, the spatial mapping gives a two-dimensional picture of the extent of the soil contamination. But how was the depth of the excavation determined using the real-time measurement instruments?
I'm looking quickly in our
hard
copy to
do you have the hard copy?
To see if I have the answers to some of those. I'd refer you to the hard copy, and I'm looking to see if to make sure that.
Well, Carl's looking for the regulatory mechanism. In most cases, at least at the Fernald example, you use a 2D map to decide your next cut. So if you're in an excavation, you go out and generate that basically horizontal plane map. And that will decide what you dig next, and
it becomes
3D. The bucket of the excavator is your 3D component, and you can choose as a project manager to either take 6 inches, which is probably what the detector is seeing, or take more on the assumption that there's going to be more contamination there. It's just basically a balancing of how slowly you want the excavation to proceed versus your cost of excavation. So if you decide to take a 6-inch cut and resample versus a 2-foot sample and cut and resample. That's basically a economics factor decision of your disposal costs and stuff like that. So that you, before you take another slice, basically another scan, and generate another two-dimensional map to decide whether you dig the next interval down or not. So basically there are lots of slices of the on a horizontal planes to see that area that you're going to cut.
And Carl, I don't know about your speed reading, but it looks like Michigan had its specific state soil cleanup criteria, again stated in the document, and then for the once the cleanup was done, then using a MARSIM approach, then it was gridded out and results compared and the statistics done to determine whether the concentrations met the state of Michigan's soil cleanup criteria.
It describes in the document a trigger level of 15 picocuries per gram for radium-226 and then they had to show compliance with a 5 picocuries per gram requirement. Those two levels, I think, probably come from the UMTRCA requirements, and so those were probably either incorporated into Michigan, it says they are Michigan soil cleanup criteria, are applied to over 100 square meter areas, and those read like the UMTRCA requirements, so I'm pretty sure that's what they're based on. The state also has waste acceptance criteria for the disposal of norm waste in state landfills, and they require an average activity concentration of norm contaminated soils placed in Michigan landfills to be below 50 picocuries per gram. So they had to keep that in mind, too, as they excavated and segregated soils.
Thank you. Do you have questions from our phone line audience?
Yeah, this is Gaston Cody with EPA. I have a question regarding how do you convert from a measurement or a reading that you get from the real-time measurement in per squares or per surface area, and you convert it to a concentration in picocuries per gram of soil. How do you do that? How does the machine do it?
I think it's based on that initial calibration of your instrument and its viewing area. Basically, you evaluate the geometry of that area and then apply your counts over basically the expected mass in that viewing field. So if it's, you know, a 2 foot circle and it's 6 inches deep, that many picocuries.
So the machine does it itself.
Yes, right. It's built into your algorithm that supports the system.
So you have to make several assumptions to come
right.
Come up with that conversion that's
okay,
built in.
Thank you.
From CJ Salgado at the California Department of Public Health, what has been your experience with the reliability of wireless data transmissions in the mobile systems illustrated in the slides, particularly in the context of large-scale mappings?
I think that the ones at Fernald, they were pretty successful. I don't remember them ever running into significant issues with the with that instrument. Obviously they weren't far from each other. They were in pretty close proximity most of the time, so you weren't very far distance between the transmitter and the receiver, so there wasn't much interference.
A simulcast question from Lynn Schwindeman at CWI in Idaho Falls. After the discussion of the case studies, would the instructors please identify other states or locations that are currently utilizing these real-time systems that you're aware of?
Well, besides the four that we highlighted in the case studies, the what slide it is exactly, but one of the early slides, 48, shows the other case study sites that are included in the document So a total of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 sites are included in the document. So there's a start. We could add some other, the other DUE sites to the list that are missing here, but and let's see. Do any other sites come to mind?
I'm trying to think of other sites that I've recently heard of, and I'm not. None of them are coming to mind at the moment of somebody currently using them. It's not coming to me at the moment. Any other sites?
But I know our program and our and the department that I work with, all of them are trained with real-time instruments and take them with them to sites, both here locally in Denver and mostly at in the western slope of Colorado, the old mining and milling sites, uranium mining and milling, and they, so they're used at many, many sites.
Do you think they're being used at Hanford?
I'm sure.
I would think so.
Yeah, I would think Hanford and probably Savannah River are both using them. I was trying to remember where Fernald's ended up at, and I think they may have ended up at Hanford.
The instruments.
Yes.
Okay. Do we have additional questions from our phone line audience? From John Carson at Shar Environmental in Ohio, do your training materials discuss the use of real-time measurement with ranked set sampling, stratified sampling, or regression estimates in conjunction with the physical samples measured by on-site or off-site labs?
The training materials do not. I think the question have they been combined with physical samples to generate statistics? And I don't think I'm familiar with anywhere where they've been put together. They've been looked at side by side as in comparisons, but I don't think I'm familiar with a site where they've been used together, which has some possibilities if you're doing some geostatistical work. But yeah, I'm not familiar with one where they've been combined.
Yeah, this is John Carson. Stratification and regression estimates would be extremely effective ways to combine the two. And if you can't get like high density mapping data with your real time measurements, for whatever reason, but you're still able to get cheap measurements that way, then rank set sampling would be a tremendously powerful technique to combine those. I think that just using the laboratory measurements for comparison is overall a very inefficient way to go about it. In statistical terms, there's a tremendous amount of information that you can actually develop through the combination of the two, a more effective combination of the two.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, that they present even additional opportunities when you're combining the two.
John,
and most of these sites have both.
John, that's useful information. Could you send us, put that question in an email to us and maybe some links to some information that would be useful for us to
sure, no problem.
Thank you.
And contact information for our instructors today is available on slide 6, as well as also being available in the associated documents. We're out of questions now, and so I am going to wrap up today's training class. I'd like to thank our instructors and thank our participants. Thank you for joining us today. If you have not already, please fill out that feedback form. We use that information and really appreciate your taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. For more information about ITRC, please visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org.